Okay, so we have everything back on screen in a slightly different aspect ratio, but close enough. So, we're talking about adding redundancy, and so a lot of codes are based on sort of adding redundant bits to your original words with the view to making them sort of more distinct. And what we mean by more distinct is having a farther Hamming distance, which means you have to change more bits to get to a new code word, so a new combination of data and redundancy. Okay. And, you know, the two basic results are that you can detect if you have a minimum Hamming distance, so that's the closest two words ever get to each other, then you can detect your Hamming distance minus one bits in error, and you could correct Hamming distance minus one over two, rounded down bits in error. Okay. And so, and you should have seen at some point in your life a number of examples of these block error codes. So the simplest one would be a parity check. So you ensure that you have either an odd or even number of ones in your code word. More sophisticated are things like Hamming codes, which allow you to do some correction, or cyclic redundancy codes, which are quite efficient in the number of bits, may or may not allow you to do any correction. Okay. So, I note these. You've seen them before. I'm not going to particularly deal with them in this module. Okay. A second class of codes, convolution codes, is aimed at giving you some level of forward error correction while still keeping the overhead semi-low and having a low implementation cost. Okay, so our block codes operated on blocks of data. Convolution codes operate on streams of data, so they operate on the continuous stream of data coming through. Okay. And they do this by having memory. Again, the stream of data is going to be broken up into blocks, but now the coding will be done on a number of blocks. Okay. And instead of just attaching a redundancy, you're going to produce a whole new stream of bits to send, so an encoded stream to send. Okay, so you don't just take your signal and tack on other bits. You you transform your signal. Okay, so the codes are classified according to how many blocks and numbers and bits they use. So you have K data bits per block. Your coding is of n bits, so that's the output. And to produce the output, we use k blocks altogether, your current block plus k minus 1 previous blocks. Okay. And so you characterize your code by these numbers. How many bits in the output? how many bits in the block and how many blocks you use. Okay. And so, for example, if you have 2, 1, 3, for every 1 bit in, you're producing 2 bits out, and you're using 2 previous bits plus the current bits to produce that code. And so, one characterization of these codes would be the coding rate, which is essentially the bits in over the bits out. So, essentially for every 1 bit in, you're producing 2 bits out. So you're halving your actual data rate. It's a bit the idea of improving your resilience to loss or to error. Okay. Now there's a lot of mathematics behind how these codes are produced, and we aren't going to do that. What we will do is just see how they work. Okay. And so, again, in terms of implementation, you can use shift registers to store your bits, and then you come up with simple binary operations on those bits. And we'll see how they can be then encoded and decoded. Okay. So here we have that aforementioned 2, 1, 3 encoder. So for every 1 bit in, we're producing 2 bits out, and those 2 bits are arrived at using a combination of the current bit and 2 previous bits. So each of the 2 bits out is just a binary operation on our 3 input bits, or our input bit plus the history. Send them out one after the other. Okay. So in this case, the first output bit is the exclusive OR of all 3 bits, and the second output bit is the exclusive OR of the current bit, and then the bit two back. Now, the nice thing is about these codes is that it's relatively easy to match the output and the input together. So one way to think of that is in terms of a state machine. Okay. And so your state machine is going to track this history that we're thinking about, so the previous 2 bits. And then obviously when you get another bit in, it keeps moving. Okay. And so you can determine the output based on these previous 2 bits plus the current input bit. Okay. So we have couple of things going on here. The first is just moving from state to state based on your input bit. So the solid line is an input of 0. So if you're in state 1-1, so your previous two bits were a 1 and a 1, you get a 0 in, well, the next state is the previous two bits were a 0 and a 1. Okay. And so that would be what's at the next bit on with Orion C. Okay. So that's easy. That just means that either a 1 or a 0 arrives, and you move into another state based on whether a 1 or a 0 arrives. Your output, again, is determined by these previous two bits plus what came in, a 1 or a 0. So we can add that information to our state machine. So in this case, the previous two bits were 1-1. Another 1 arrives. Now, 1 plus 1, these are exclusive ORs. 1 exclusive OR, exclusive OR with 1 gives you 1. 1 exclusive OR with itself gives you 0. So your output there is going to be 1-0. Okay. So that's, it's just a representation of all the information we need to know about this code. And, what you can think is that, when we're coming up with the output, we can get that information and attach it to these transitions. When we're examining the output, we can go back to the same state machine and from the output read off then what the input must have been. So if you know you're in this state and you see an output of 1-0, you must have been transmitted. The original bit must have been a 1. So that's sort of straightforward enough. We'll go through an example of that. What's clever about this coding is what happens if something goes wrong, if one of your bits flips and you don't receive what was sent, you receive something different than what was sent. There are still ways of recovering the original transmission. Okay. So, to take a concrete example, we can start with some input U is 0110. So if we try and arrive at our code to start with, we start in state 0, we have an input of 0 that gives us an output of 00. So that's our first two digits here. Our next input is a 1. That takes us to state B, and our output is 1-1. Our next input is 1, which takes us to state D with an output of 0-1, and our last input is 0, which takes us to state C with an output of 0-1. Okay. So we get that code, we send that code, and again, we can think of, now we want to recreate our original sequence. So what is the decoder going to do? Well, we start in state 0. Now we received our 0-0. Well, that corresponds to and input 0, that's our first digit, then 1, 1, that corresponds to an input of 1, and then 0, 1, trace that corresponds to an input of 1, and finally, we're down to state D, and we get a 0, and this is state C, and corresponds to an input of 0. So, assuming we get everything correctly, we can just trace it off. Another way of representing this is what's called a trellis. And that's where trellis coding comes from. And all this trellis is doing is it's expanding out that state machine as you move through time. It's giving you all the possible paths through the state machine. Okay. So you start, you know, at time 0, well, you know you're in state 0, and you can either go to state A or to state B. And so at time 1, you're either in A or B, and you know, you can either go to A or B, or from B you can go to C or D. So it's just you know, a visual representation of expanding that out. Okay. And again, if we want to look at decoding, then again we can travel. We see how we travel through this trellis, and so we go from 0, 0 to 1, 1 to 0, 1 to 0, 1 again. And we see that our first step took us along the single path. Okay. Now, the question becomes then, what happens if there's an error? So, what happens if what we receive is not what we're sent? And again, it's possible to determine at least what was the most likely path, or what was the most likely correct transmission. Okay, and so the way it's going to do this is, well, it's going to examine all possible paths that you take through this trellis, and it's going to look at the Hamming distance from any legitimate sequence. Okay. And depending, again, how far you go, you can sort of tend to pair off more and more sequences. Okay. The technique that is used to attempt this correction is what's called the Viterbi algorithm. Okay. So, again, the idea is that you're going to compare the received sequence to all possible sequences and choose the closest one. You have to cut off your examination after a while. You can only examine a fixed length sequence. So, for any, yeah, so when you examine a window, some sort of window size of B blocks, okay. Now, even within the window, you know, again, when you're in any given state, there were probably a number of ways you could have gotten there. And mean, some of them are going to have smaller handing distances than others. So you only need to look at the ones with the smaller handing distances. So you can eliminate anything that got you to the same point, but with a greater handing distance. Okay. So, again, if you receive a code sequence, at each state, you sort of move forward one time, at one state at a time, and you look at the paths that could have gotten you to each of the states at that time point, and you keep the paths which give you the minimum Hamming distance for that point. After you've done your B blocks of that, after you look at B points, you move forward B in your trellis, then you look at the paths you have left. If they all have the same first edge, you say that's your first. That's your sample point. If they don't have the first edge, then you can't correct the error. Okay. When you've done that for the first one, you just keep going for the second, third, fourth, you select your window forward. Okay, so anyway, if you look at the example here, if you only start in state 0, so you should either have a 0,0 or a 1,1. Instead, what we receive is 1,0. Okay. Now, if we looked just at that, there's no way of saying which one's more likely. But if we, again, because of the history built into it, if we look at more samples, we get a clearer picture of what's going on. So, what can we do? Well, the first step is going to either keep us at A with 0,0 or move us to B with 1,1. And either way, to get to either of those paths, you would have to change one bit. Okay. So at that point, your 1 and 1, your hand distances are 1 and 1. Okay. Now, if you look at having an input of 0 or an output of 0,0, you're still in state A, and therefore your next code should either be 0,0 or 1,1, and it's actually 0,1. So in order to move from this state to any other state, you're going to have to change one more bit of your original, of your incoming sequence. So you're going to get 2,2 there. If you were in state B, then you either move to D with a 0,1, which is no additional bits change, so move to D gives you a 1. Or, what else can you do? You can move to C, and with 1,0, a 1,0 means you're going to have to change both your bits, so you're going to get handled this 3 for that. Okay. Now, as you go on, again, you are calculating your Hamming distances to get to the state at a certain point in time. But as you move on, there will be more than one path to that state. Okay. So, as an example, in step three, you get to C, where you could either get to C from D, and that would be no additional cost in terms of Hamming distance, because the Rx was 0, 1, so that would be Hamming distance 1. Or you could have gotten to C from B, but that would have given you a higher Hamming distance. So you eliminate that path from your consideration. Okay. Similarly, for state A, you can stay in state A with a Hamming distance of 3, or you could get to state A from the previous state B, but you can change in something so you've got a higher Hamming distance. So again, once you have a path that has a higher Hamming distance, you can just eliminate that path. Okay. And so you keep going on with eliminating paths that give you higher Hamming distances, and eventually, again, you get to a point where your window ends, so you've considered everything in the window. And when you've considered everything in the window, you take a look at just this first transition. Okay. And what you're hoping is that you've got a clear winner. And in this case, you do have a clear winner in terms of the first transition. Okay. So you come to the conclusion that the code should have been that you went from state A to state B, which was an input of 1. Okay. And so should have been a code of 1, 1. So this should have been a code of 1, 1, and your original input should have been 1. Okay. So, things get even more complicated from there. Usually these convolution codes are used in conjunction with other coding methods. One of the most common would be turbo coding. And turbo coding just combines a number of encoders in order to, again, improve your results. And it uses 2 additional techniques. It uses interleaving. And so in interleaving, you rearrange the bits, the ordering of the bits, to try and guard against burst errors. And the second technique is referred to as puncturing. So you don't necessarily send then all of your code bits. You only send a selection of your code bits, and you you estimate the code bits at the other end. Okay. So again, you will have your signal. And then we'll have an encoded version, then you will interleave the signal, and you will encode the interleaving, and then you will multiplex all of that together, and then you will send a reduced set of data. Okay. And typically what happens then is that these encoders further encode coding, you know, they encode each other's codes so that you can extract the information at the end. Okay. So, again, the main thing is to sort of ponder out of this is just the basic idea of convolution coding and be able to produce and the codes and decode information as well. Okay, so again, there's in terms of channel coding, you're sending more bits than in your original signal. And we can do that using blocking coding, but typically blocking coding doesn't allow for great forward error correction. Or you can use convolution coding and or turbo coding, which allows you to do forward error correction fairly well. Now, you can, again, characterize this result to relate the bit error rate to the signal-to-noise ratio, or sorry, the bit energy to noise density ratio, and basically, well, for any coding, what you hope is that for any encoded signal, you will get an improved for any signal, you'll get an improved loss ratio relative to the energy you're putting into the signal. Okay. So, again, for any EB over N0, we see that you have a smaller probability of error with coding than without. There's always some point where, the signal is so bad, or again, that coding actually doesn't help. It makes things worse. Okay, so the last thing we'll talk about today is modulation. And so modulation just refers to the formation of bits in some fashion that you can distinguish at least a 0 and a 1 from each other. And again, you have to form these bits as a sinusoid, and you use some you change some characteristic then of the sinusoid to send the bit. Okay, or to distinguish the two bits. Now, what we're going to look at today are sort of our basic modulation techniques. So ones that do indeed change amplitude, phase, frequency in a fairly straightforward fashion. As we go through the module, we will look at certain other techniques which have good properties in terms of efficient use of bandwidth, things like orthogonal frequency division multiplexing, spread spectrum techniques. But right now, we'll just look at, again, the basic techniques. Okay, so what are concerns? Well, again, our concerns are our energy efficiency, especially sort of mobile communication systems, and what the science information or bits using as little power as possible. We need to try and avoid interference with neighbor signals, so that pretty much means keeping a bandwidth, keeping within a tight bandwidth. And then, you know, just in terms of a single transmission, you also are concerned with just, you know, your bit error rate and sort of how the transmission will perform for a single individual as well. Okay, so again, you have your signal is a single frequency audio tone known as a carrier, and then you want to change something about that carrier. And so since it's a sinusoid, there are only three things you can change. You can change the amplitude, you can change the phase, so you can move it along your time axis, and you can change the frequency. Okay. And so we say that your signal is keyed according to one of those three, one or more of those three characteristics. Additionally, it's possible to change things so you can distinguish between more than one bit. So, if you change things in one way, then you have a single bit. But you know, there's no reason that you can't distinguish, say, two bits. So then you have to have four distinct changes. So there's two different elements that are referred to then, and so the signaling rate or baud rate is the rate at which the signaling element is transmitted. But if you're, for instance, distinguishing or representing two bits per signaling element, then the bit rate is going to be twice that. If you're representing three bits, the bit rate is three times that. Okay. So, you know, the first thing, again, you can do is change the amplitude. So either, typically, you can go between 1 and 0. It's not used a lot. Second thing you can do is change your frequency. And so, again, depending on how many times you change it, you can represent more bits. If you just want a 0 and a 1, then you can take your carrier frequency and just do plus minus some F0. Okay. Okay, so again, depending on how many times you can shift your frequency, you can represent more bits. So multiple frequency shift keying will have more than two separate frequencies. Okay. And so again, you start off with a carrier frequency, and then you move it by some modulation frequency. Okay. if you wanted to represent L bits, then you need 2 to the L different frequencies, and so again, you just have to represent those all. The other aspect that you can change is the phase. With phase shift keying. And so the most basic version of that is to have a 180 degree phase shift between two signals, so that's like a plus minus. And the problem with that is that it's more difficult to demodulate. And what you typically want to do is to keep the phase shifts relatively small. And so differential phase shift keying uses a phase shift of 90 degrees relative to, plus minus 90 degrees relative to the current signal. And so, again, if we think of our original carrier, then phase shift keying is just flipping it depending on whether you're a 1 or a 0. Whereas with the differential phase shift keying, again, you're moving your phase by plus or minus 90. Depending relative to the previous signal. Okay. Okay, so you know, again, you can have multiple phase changes relative. You can have more than 2 phase changes, so you get 4 phase changes that you can represent 2 bits, and again, there's multiple ways of doing that. Typically, you divide your signal up into 2 streams and modulate each stream separately. If you send then the 2 streams together in phase, then again you can get phase shifts of up to 180 degrees, which can be difficult for circuitry. If you offset the phases by 1 bit when you're transmitting, then your changes are only going to be 90 degrees at a time, and that gives you better error characteristics. Okay. Again, you can see what the phase differentials will be. Okay. Other techniques, like the minimum shift keying, is a form of frequency shift keying, but one that seeks to minimize the power at which we transmit, and it is found in some wireless systems. What else can you do? You can combine various techniques, so quadrature amplitude modulation varies both the amplitude and the phase of the signal, and again is found in some wireless standards, although not too many modern ones. Okay, and so again, you've probably seen those types of techniques before. And the main thing that we might note is just, again, the performance of the system varies depending on what technique you're using. So typically we can relate EV over N0 to bandwidth efficiency for the various schemes. Okay. And so depending on what scheme you're using, you will have different bandwidth efficiencies, and those bandwidth efficiencies are also going to be related to exactly how you implement the scheme. So we introduce this factor R, which is related to filtering techniques, which, you know, depending on how you do it, can be better or worse for each one scheme. And so again, this is from Stalling. We see that our different schemes are going to give us better or worse bandwidth efficiencies, depending. Okay. So what we want is a high R to PT. And we can see, again, for any given scheme, that's going to depend on how you implement the scheme. And then, even within that, you know, different schemes are going to improve your bandwidth efficiency more than others. Okay. And we see that for frequency, shift keying, your bandwidth efficiency actually decreases with the number of levels. For phase shift keying, bandwidth efficiency increases for the number of levels. There's also, for each scheme, you get a different relationship between the bit error rate and the bit energy to noise density level. And so we can see that if you're just sending distinguishing single bits, then it was an order of efficiency, or it was an order, so for any EV of N0. The phase shift keying works better than the frequency shift keying. And then within either phase shift keying or frequency shift keying, the number of levels also can improve or disimprove with the error rate. So we fix EV over N0, then for, so frequency shift keying, the more levels you have, the better, and for phase shift keying, the less levels you have, the better. Okay, and we can also we can trade off between these concepts. So if you have bit error rates, well, then That's going to be related to the median friend zero, which we know is in turn related to the signal to noise ratio. So we can examine the trade-offs between all of these different concepts given a certain modulation technique. Okay, so we'll wrap up today with looking at how that works. Okay. So, again, we can relate EB over N0 to our signal-to-noise ratio and our bandwidth efficiency, and we can also relate EB over N0 to our EB over N0 to our bit error rate. So if we look, the relationship between EB over N0 and signal to noise ratio is in terms of our bandwidth efficiency. And so if we have a fixed signal to noise ratio, then we can, depending on what bit error rate we want, then we can figure out what bandwidth efficiency we need. Okay. So, let's see. So we can start by looking at, we want a bit error rate of 10 to the minus 7. And again, depending on what our modulation technique is, we get a different required EB over N0. So for BPSK, it's around 11.2. For DPSK, it's around 12. For ASK and BFSK, it's around 14.2. Okay. And so the difference between the EB over N0 and their signal to noise ratio is the bandwidth efficiency. And so we can calculate what each of those is. And again, achieving them depends on then how clever you are with your technique, with your filtration techniques. Okay. Similarly, again, we can look at how levels interact with the systems and change the calculations. So now, suppose we want to fix our EB over N0. We can think about how that affects our VDR and our bandwidth efficiency. We can think about how it does that for different levels. Okay. So, for a frequency shift keying system, if you want EB over N0 is 10, then you can see that it looks better. Bit error rates for higher levels. Worse error rates. Yeah, where are those? And so if you look on your the charts, those are roughly what you're going to get. Now, if we want then to calculate the bandwidth efficiency, then we have to look at what you get relative to the different levels. Okay, and did we do that? Okay. And, yeah, again, you can write that off your chart. Okay. So, what you can see here is that with the levels, your bandwidth efficiency is decreasing with the number of levels, but your bit error rate is also improving. So, you get these sorts of trade-offs going on. Okay, so that's it for today. Some of this again should be review. There's some new concepts in there. And again, what the goal of a digital comm system is to try and accurately transmit a sequence of bits over a distance. And there are limitations to what we can do. There's limitations to the capacity of a channel, which just gives us the rate at which we can transmit data. It's going to introduce errors into the transmission of data. How that happens depends partially on our modulation schemes and also the amount of basically power we're willing to pump into the system. Okay. And so we designed a number of different components that sort of try to combat these effects. What we're going to look at next week is the actual transmission of our signal over, specifically a radio channel. And so everything we've set up to here, you could send your modulated signal down a wire just as easily as, through the air. Okay, so what we're going to look at next week is what characteristics of transmitting things over a radio channel are there, and how is it different, again, from a wired signal. And so then sort of the basic properties from that are what's used in the design, for instance, of a cellular system. Pretty much the design of any system, but we'll see how that all works anyway. Okay, so that's it for today. So enjoy the rest of your week, and I'll see you guys next week. Oh, come on, tell me.